Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger, by now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights. Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. Occasionally, we have a show that when the show's over, we've barely scratched the surface, and the volume of calls makes clear that you want more. Given the demand, we circle back to one such program. Tonight, we resume our discussion of common real property issues that affect us all to some extent, often quality of life issues such as disputes between neighbors or easements or zoning.
You have folks walking past your house as a shortcut, and then they claim an easement over your house, over your lawn. What do you do? Your neighbor decides to tear down your fence as he wants one that looks better facing his house, but this will damage your landscaping. So what do you do? And tonight we look at these and other common real property issues.
As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and to answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, at 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. If you're not, if you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't always have the salient facts in your case. But we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. And you can call us with any question on tonight's topic, any question of real property laws, issues facing homeowners. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. So, Josh, who do we have lined up to guide us through this discussion tonight?
We have two great panelists. First, from the San Jose office of Mattioni, O'Loughlin, and Heckman, Barton Heckman represents businesses and property owners in transactions involving easements, CC&Rs, and the acquisition, development, and uses of real property in obtaining governmental approvals, including use permits, general plan and zoning changes, and in defending property owners accused of municipal code violations. He's currently the chair of the Palo Alto Planning and Transportation Commission. And our second guest is Andrew Junius, who's a land use and real estate attorney and currently serves as the chairman of Rubin, Junius & Rose, LLP, where his practice is concentrated in San Francisco, representing a variety of developers and property owners. Over the last 30 years, Andrew has appeared before many different boards and commissions in San Francisco and other Bay Area communities, representing different commercial and residential land use developments, and is very involved in the local political and business scene in the city. Andrew chairs the San Francisco Building Owners and Managers Association, known as BOMA, their political action committee.
And as I understand, you're both involved now in local political. I see a smile on your face, Bart. Are you? Is that true? You're both now on different boards?
Yes, Andrew has joined me. Andrew, I'll let you break the news.
I just a month or so ago, I was appointed to the Sausalito Planning Commission. So I'm one of the five planning commissioners. And my first meeting is in a couple of weeks in June 2nd. So looking forward to 3 years of fun here in Sausalito.
Excellent, Andrew. Congratulations. And Andrew Junius, Bart Heckman, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You know, before we go further, I wanted to begin with a simple question. The last time we did this, I spoke of home ownership. I've owned my home for close to a quarter century, and for most of these issues, I was asking if there's a place I should go. What if I owned a condominium, and I had some of these same issues? So I may not have boundary issues in the usual sense, but I have other issues. People living in closer proximity, you would think that more of these issues arise. Where do I go?
You want to lead off?
Well, if the specific question is where do you go to find out, you know, how your condo association works, you should dig through that file when you bought the condo and dig out those CC&Rs, the covenants, conditions, and restrictions. That is the roadmap, kind of the constitution for these kind of organizations. Condominiums can be, you know, very small, you know, two or three units to, you know, hundreds or even thousands of units. And the evolving condominium law, you know, state of California condominium law is always changing. There's actually, Bart can probably speak to this better than I can. There have been some pretty significant changes recently in how condominiums work. But usually a lot of the things that, you know, you'll have questions about will be very, whether they're clearly written in the CC&Rs, probably depends on when the CC&Rs are written. You know, old ones can be a little clunky. Newer ones can be overkill. Sometimes they're a little hard to work with, but you always start with the CC&Rs.
Can I follow up that with a question? So what if the CC&Rs go what a person would consider a little far? They don't say it initially when you buy, but then they have, how far can they go? No dogs, no windows being covered all the time. You need to have drapes. Some, from my understanding, can be very draconian. How far are they allowed to go?
What do you think, Bart? You probably handled more of those than I have.
They can go pretty far, frankly. There are some areas that they can't go. For example, in some of these older CC&Rs, you will actually find race-based prohibitions. And the Supreme Court decided long ago that those are simply invalid. But there are fairly tight controls, depending upon the CC&Rs, on sometimes on your behavior, and those are generally allowed. And really, you have to. It serves you well when you're buying a condo, and there are actually single family neighborhoods that also have CC&Rs. You really should spend some time reading those, but before you buy, because those are the rules. It's another layer of rules beyond whatever the city's rules are, and they apply to the owner of that condo or house, and you're buying into that deal if you accept them.
If I have an old single family home, I probably have a pretty good idea of the nature of the documents that govern what I can and can't do. But if I'm buying into a development or perhaps a condominium, isn't it fair to say it's like another 20 or 30 pages of fine print that I should really know before I sign on to buy?
It can be the same 20 or 30 pages. I actually have I live in a single family neighborhood, and I have a set of CC&Rs that apply to my neighborhood, which was it's an Eichler neighborhood, and it was, you know, built along with I think 72 other homes, and we all have the same rules that we abide by. One thing you find, I think, in older CC&Rs is in all CC&Rs, sometimes you'll find architectural control committees, or there's some committee of owners within your development that has been appointed to make frequently aesthetic decisions, and sometimes to even mediate disputes. And so that is a resource that you need to be aware of. And a lot of times, particularly in single family homes, where you have an ability to do something outside, but you first have to check with the architectural control committee or submit an application. You have to run it by them before you even submit it to the city to get that permit. You don't really have that issue in a condo, because in a condo, all you own is the airspace, the inside of the unit. And so any improvements you want to make are going to be limited to the inside. And so you're never going to be asking about what you can do outside. That's a decision made by the owners association.
I think that leads us into our next topic, which is zoning. And so we hear about this all the time. For our listeners out there, can you give an explanation, either one of you, what is zoning? And then it would be great if we could go into the same type of question with the CC&Rs. What are the parameters of zoning? What can the cities do, and when do they step too far?
I'll get a kick that one off. Zoning is actually really fascinating, you know, because it's something that really touches everybody's property. No matter where you live in America, there's some zoning that likely touches you. And it comes from the, you know, the innate police powers, the governing powers that every municipality, you know, county, city, town, whatever, has to make rules. Towns have the ability to make lots of rules. And I think the most important rules they are making with respect to real estate are almost always zoning rules. So in some respects, you know, tearing off the CC&R conversation, it's the same kind of concept. There's a zoning ordinance, sometimes called the planning code, that governs how you can use your property and what you can, you know, build on your property. Things like physical, things like height limits, floor area ratios that depend, you know, regulate the size of your building. Setbacks are pretty common. And then when you talk about uses, the zoning map will very clearly tell you where certain types of activities belong in the city. And this is a pretty old principle that goes back to the early 20th century, where they basically started to separate out, you know, you don't want to, you know, a smelting factory or a hog butcher next to a residential neighborhood. So people started to, you know, create residential zoning where only people can live. And some of the residential zoning is pretty exclusive. Some residential zoning is very specific, only a single family home per lot. Some allow multifamily, you know, units. And that's a big debate right now in terms of how we produce more housing in California. But, you know, the bottom line is the zoning is the first place you would, kind of like the CC&R, it's just the first place you would want to go to make sure that the property you're buying, for example, will allow you to do what you want to do. I mean, a lot of what I do in my practice is advise both people buying buildings as to what they can do with their building, and people leasing spaces in a very complicated jurisdiction like San Francisco. It's extremely difficult sometimes to figure out if the use that's being proposed actually works in the zoning district that the person is targeted to land in. So it's both uses and construction, and it gets really complicated. I mean, way more complicated, I think, than CC&Rs. CC&Rs can be, you know, as Bart was mentioning, they can be pretty involved, but zoning codes these days run into thousands of pages and they become extraordinarily technical and very, very complex to sort out.
You know, I just got a text from a caller, a listener who wanted me to ask you, has anybody on the panel heard of Associa, a company used for homeowners associations? Apparently, this is a privatized one, a corporate one. I didn't know if anybody was familiar with it. And if so, did they have any opinions?
I haven't heard of it. This is Bart.
Well, I mean, there are lots of groups that will, like, you know, for small, you know, thinking about how a homeowners association works, it's like a little, you know, it's a little owners group, right? You've got 100 units and then 10 people are on the board and they kind of try to run things. Usually that works when the multifamily, you know, situation or the multiple condos are large enough. But if you get into really small, you know, 2-unit, 6-unit condominiums, it's hard for them to like know what to do. Nobody seems to, you know, it's really difficult. Oftentimes you just offload that to a company that will handle the, you know, the maintenance books and the budgeting. And there's a lot of stuff that, you know, CC&R or homeowner associations are supposed to keep up on. And it can be sometimes difficult when nobody is experienced and there aren't enough people to kind of carry the load. So there are companies that will handle that for small groups.
So before we went to the listener's question, we were just starting to talk a little bit about zoning. Does this also go so far often as the neighbor down the street who used a color scheme for his house that may look a lot like something you'd see in another country rather than here? Is that type of thing often covered?
Tangentially, maybe. Zoning typically won't control color schemes, but in some places it does. For example, in Santa Clara County, they have an emphasis on ensuring that structures that are visible from the valley floor or sometimes from scenic roadways need to go through a design review process to make sure that they are aesthetically attractive. And they don't, and in the view shed issue, a lot of times they are imposing reflections, reflectability schemes on, you know, the materials you use on the outside, and maybe even paint colors so that they're sort of muted and more earth toned so that they don't, you know, pop out when you're looking up at the hillside like a pink house would. But generally people are free to have their own paint colors on their homes.
I mean, the flip side of that, though, like in San Francisco, there are certain historic districts where they will try to regulate paint colors and whatnot. Again, as Bart was saying, to kind of keep the consistency. It's a little bit of a stretch. I agree with Bart. It's pretty rare. a lot of these things get dealt with you know, design review through the planning department staff and ultimately at the planning commission. But they can strongly suggest, they can tell you they're not going to support the project if it's covered in mirrored glass. You know, there was a high rise ban on mirrored glass in San Francisco for a long time, after the Marriott came in, and, you know, things like that. But once they get really, really close to the aesthetics, it starts to become just a battle of wills. You know, is the developer or the property owner want to hang in long enough to try to really get exactly what they want, or will they just kind of make a deal with the planners?
Listeners, do you want to learn the basics of how to manage your money? Learn about credit reports or bankruptcy. Next week on May 26th from 5 to 6 p.m., Legal Access Alameda, in partnership with Elevate Community Center's Executive Director, Shireen Shand, and bankruptcy attorney Sally Elkington, will be hosting a Facebook Live event called The Financial Basics. It will be streaming live on Legal Access Alameda's Facebook page. Head to facebook.com/LegalAccessAlameda to tune in. You could submit questions in the chat to join in on the conversation. The panelists will be talking about the basics of how to budget, bankruptcy, credit reports, and credit scores. That's at 5 o'clock on Wednesday, May 26th, runs from 5 to 6 p.m. Then at 6, your legal rights is here to answer your landlord-tenant questions. What are some more common zoning issues that you see, whether you can add a front porch to your house or where to put the windows or what types of things?
I think a lot of the action, if you will, in the zoning code has to do not so much with the permitted uses. Every zoning code will have a series of uses that are allowed in really the focus of that zoning district. So, for example, I live in an R1 district, which is single family homes. And that is the focus. And those single family homes are allowed as a matter of right, still need a building permit, but you don't need a use permit. I think really where the interesting issues are is in almost every district, there are other uses that might be all right if under the right conditions. And those uses generally need to apply for something called a conditional use permit. And through a process of review and hearing, the city or county decides what conditions need to be imposed on that use to make it compatible with the neighborhood. And so we see a lot of that kind of work.
Well, let me follow that up. What happens if the conditions, the conditions are trying to lessen the impact of whatever you're trying to do. But what if what the city is trying to get at isn't really about lessening the impact, but they just decide they want something else out of you? Does that happen? What happens there?
That happens all the time. That's part of the... part of the dialogue. I mean, a conditional use comes with a lot of conditions. And oftentimes the conditions can be, you know, things that, are things that consistent with, you know, general public good and welfare and whatnot. But a lot of times that stuff gets kind of codified to a degree and, you know, we've actually gotten to a better place where it's not just kind of being asked for things that you're like, well, where did that come from? That the reason why the planning codes in a lot of these cities are so big is because they've got that list now. I mean, like, for example, a good example would be something like, I want to build an office building in the downtown, you know, in downtown center. And I'd like to just build my office building, but I start looking at the planning code and the office building. It's like, well, we need you to devote a little bit of your site for open space. We'd like you to help beautify, you know, downtown. So we're going to make you set your building back and provide, you know, 500 square feet for a little parklet in front of your building. And, oh, by the way, we'd like you to put a piece of artwork there. There's an art requirement now in the downtown to provide some budget for, you get to pick the art, you're going to do some art for us, right? Right. You know, so all those kind of things start to add to the, you know, conditionality of all of these types of approvals, whether they're, you know, straightforward conditional uses like Bart was mentioning, or super exotic, office or laboratory entitlements or other things that you have in big cities like San Francisco or San Jose or Oakland.
Well, it sounds like, though, that your conditions can, your permit can be held hostage and you have no choice but to agree to whatever condition they want, even if it has absolutely nothing to do with the negative impact that they say is going to come about from what you want to do. There has to be a boundary there, no?
There is. There are a couple of them. One's provided in the Constitution, and another's provided in state law. The constitutional limit is arises from the takings clause in the state and federal constitution as interpreted by the state and U.S. Supreme Court. And it basically says there has to be some connection between the condition you're imposing, whether it's art or sometimes it's a monetary, it's a fee. There has to be a connection to an impact being caused by the project, and the extent of the condition has to be proportional to the impact that you're trying to address. So that's the constitutional issue. On the state side, we have something called the Mitigation Fee Act, which looks at the kinds of fees that cities and counties charge, imposes conditions to development, and gives an applicant the opportunity to challenge the extent of those fees. It's a well thought out law because it allows them to challenge it without stopping the project. The project can go forward and sort of suspend that condition while the courts determine it. Andrew, do you have more thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, actually, I think the Mitigation Fee Act is a good thing and works okay, but I do think that you've got to perfect your claim. You actually have to pay the fee, and you're basically suing for like a refund. So you can move forward, but it's a refund you're going to try to get, you're not going to delay the payment of these fees. And frankly, in big cities, the fees are pretty significant. But, you know, Bart hits a really important point. I think one of the things that a lot of residential developers, for example, now are being hit with are market rate developers are being asked to pay into affordable housing funds or actually produce affordable housing. And it goes right back. That's a pretty easy one, when developers come in, the city can make a pretty decent case to say, like, look, you're going to impact affordability here. And I think the courts would have upheld the fact that, yes, local jurisdictions can ask you to pay into affordable housing funds or devote affordable units. That's kind of a settled question. Some of the other ones out there get a little funky. I never really thought about whether there's a nexus, to the art requirements that a lot of cities have. That starts to get a little into the edges. But even with that, I mean, I think, frankly, those are ones that benefit projects, and I've never really had anybody complain too much about having to put some art in their building, to increase the beautification of a downtown, et cetera.
And Andrew alluded to this, but there's also a practical aspect to this, and that is when you're an applicant and you're hit with one of these fees, you have to make a decision. How quickly do I want to move forward with my project? Do I really want to stop and litigate this and, spend all that money? Or is the quickest path just to, choke it down and move forward even though I know it's wrong? And I'd say more often than not, the applicant chokes it down because they want to get the thing done that they're applied to do.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, and I'm joined tonight by co-host Josh Borger. And tonight, we have an all-star cast. We're taking a look at common real property issues with Bart Hechtman and Andrew Janius. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to planning for your real estate or even transferring your business or practice in anything, any real estate issue. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. And let me turn it to Nomi from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Is that me, Nomi?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, hi.
You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Residential, single-family home, San Francisco, Edwardian, 1915 built. We're trying to remodel. We're being told by the planning department that we have to adhere to certain standards with our windows in the front of the house. And I'm okay with that. The significant problem for us is that we're a single family, but our windows are in the second story. So in order to really manage our windows and take care of them, we have to have scaffolding done, and it's a big financial process just to maintain the windows. So our hope was, well, what if we did like an aluminum wood clad or, you know, some other material that also involved wood but was able to, at least at the surface level, externally be able to protect that wood, given that we are, you know, facing the west and those windows are being beat down by the wind and all kind of other environmental factors, and I'm being told you can't do that. And my argument to the planning department was, well, there are other people in the neighborhood who have done something sort of similar and different. And, you know, we are in a time of a little bit higher technology where we don't have to have wood windows. So just wondering, I understand some of the thinking behind it, but I feel like there's a resistance to a certain level of change in coming to terms with, you know, higher points of technology, more efficiency. You know, we got Title 24 in the state, and I feel like, you know, how can I argue for something different, or am I wasting my time? I'll take my answer off the air unless you have a question for me.
Nomi, thank you for joining us. I see both Bart and Andrew are nodding, so I think we have some good answers coming up. Who wants to jump in?
I've been through this a million times in San Francisco. You're dealing with, you know, a part of the planning department that specializes in historic preservation issues like this, and they're very careful and meticulous about these type of issues. And windows are one of their favorite things to to try to protect. The unfortunate thing for homeowners like you that have purchased, you know, a 100-year-old home, and it's, I'm sure you're taking as good a care of it as you can. But the city, through a variety of different angles, can require these things. And you certainly have the ability to keep asking, because they have an enormous amount of discretion to, you know, maybe, I wouldn't say look the other way, but to, you know, to consider all the circumstances. And expense certainly is a circumstance on your side that usually doesn't, you know, make much of a difference for the planners. Their job is to help you understand that, you know, as the steward of this home that you own, they really want you to take good care of it. And they're really, you know, to the extent you're trying to replace wooden windows with aluminum windows or more efficient windows, that's really going to be difficult. I don't think it's impossible. I think the unfortunate thing about the way San Francisco works is there isn't an easy way for you to, like, get a second opinion. There's, you know, you're kind of locked in a debate with the planning department, and they're telling you what their rules are, and they're probably telling you, we can't really change this. This is the way we do things. And I'm sorry if you think somebody else down the street got a different deal or whatever. But the unfortunate thing is it's not impossible, but it's really difficult for you to kind of take that up the ladder and get, for example, appeal the decision to something like the Board of Appeals. It's possible, very convoluted. You actually have to apply for the permit, have it denied, and then appeal within a certain amount of time. And that's difficult, but if it's really that, you know, if it's really that, financially much of a hardship for you, maybe the people at the board of, you know, the five commissioners at the Board of Appeals may be, interested in hearing from you. But in some respects, I think the staff is just going to keep telling you their hands are tied. These are our rules. I'm sorry. You need to protect the historic fabric of your home. And that includes the wood sash windows. And, you know, unless you can come up with something that really, you know, some new technology that, you know, I'm not even sure that would work, because again, their whole idea here is to try to preserve the home in its current state, and that includes the wood windows. So you're in a tough spot. Bart, you've come across this as well.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to thank you, Nomi, for buying a piece of history and taking care of it and, you know, wanting to fix it up. And I do appreciate your frustration. I think I think it's particularly apt in San Francisco, because I think San Francisco is unusual compared to other, you know, the biggest cities in the U.S. in that people come to San Francisco to see the historic homes. You know, they actually, you know, tour that. That's not true in Chicago or New York so much, but San Francisco is known for these homes, and you have one of them. So congratulations on that. I do agree with Andrew that it's going to be a steep uphill climb. And part of the reason is that that the historic preservation concept is not just about the aesthetic, the look of the front of the building, the part that people can see. It's also about the materials. They want those because that's part of the fabric of those old structures, and so they want to remain true to the materials, and that would include the window casings. If they have historically been wood, which of course they were, they're going to want to stay true to that. So I think it would be very difficult for you to convince them otherwise. Even though I agree with your statement that you could do this in a way that you know somebody looking from the street will not be able to tell that it's not wood.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
David Shore has created some hugely successful dramas like House and The Good Doctor, and now his long career in TV is being honored at this year's Canadian Screen Awards. David will tell you what draws him to procedural dramas and if his law degree has helped him out any. That's coming up on Q from PRX.
A 7 o'clock check-in for Q from the CBC, followed by 8 o'clock's All Songs Considered here on member-supported 91.7 FM. KALW and online at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyers Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For more information, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
Next week on Your Legal Rights, Wednesday night at 6, we feature a program on landlord-tenant questions with three of the best: Jessica Chalik, Sal Timpano of San Francisco, and San Mateo's David Finkelstein, with yet more programs to help landlords with back rent and the moratorium on evictions due to end in just weeks. We're back due to popular demand. We return to answer your landlord-tenant questions at our usual time, Wednesday at 6 o'clock. But tonight, we have an all-star cast. We're taking a look at common real property issues. If you have questions, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. As always, call regarding any question on tonight's topic, your real estate questions. You don't have to jump in on the exact spot we are in our conversation, as will Guadalupe from Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. Thanks for listening to my questions. So I have this issue. I live kind of in a hill, not quite a hill, but it is sloping down. And my neighbor decided to dump a pool full of water onto my property. And it went down through the property line. And in addition to that, he has been dumping dog feces and trash against my house. And so now he sold the house and he moved. He was well aware of what happened to my property. He offered his insurance information, but his insurance was only willing to pay $3,000 for the damage wall, the retaining wall. And so I had been struggling with a lot of issues related to COVID, and so I haven't been able to follow up. But the time to, you know, the 2 years, it's coming up, and so I am really stranded. I don't know what to do. I hate to go to court, but I need some help. I don't know what else to do. I tried to reach them, but they have not been able to return my calls or do anything. What do you think I can do at this point?
Before my guests answer, let me ask you one question to follow up. How long ago did they actually move?
I don't know. It must have been a year. A year and a half.
So we have the neighbor that was the ultimate nuisance.
Yes.
Who then took their problems with them, but left damage behind.
Yes.
Where can you go? Where can Guadalupe go?
You know, this is Bart. So my initial thought, you didn't mention the total extent of the damages. You did mention that I think the insurance company had offered to pay $3,000. But if the damage was under $10,000, then, you know, the cost efficient way to go forward would might be a small claims action against the property owner who's moved for taking these actions that damaged your house.
Okay. And so I wanted to know what are my chances of, you know, in addition to that, he damaged my garage. He damaged a lot of my materials, my work materials. And so, yes, it is under $10,000, but I still, you know, I mean, it's probably more than $10,000, but I will be happy if they were to pay for the retaining wall and cleaning my garage and cleaning, the wall. They were dumping trash against my garage, so that blocked a lot of the drainage and everything else. And so do you think that a small claims court will be the best venue for me?
From a cost efficiency basis, it sounds like it would be, you know, to go beyond that, to seek the full measure of damage, you have to hire a lawyer. And in these situations, it's difficult to recover your attorney's fees. So, you know, you might spend, if you spent $10,000 to get an $18,000 judgment, you really only got eight. So I think you're better served in this situation in small claims. And I think that the small claims judges, by and large, do a good job. You have work to do to present your case and to, you know, document not only the injury, the damages, but also the costs. And I think when you do that, they really strive to be equitable and fair. And I think that's your best shot at collecting money without having to pay out a lot of money on the risk that you'll get rewarded.
And it's also much faster too. I mean, a regular court action will take years. You can usually get through small claims, what, Bart, in 6 months or something? I mean, you know, it's it's doable in real time. So it works a lot better for smaller issues. So best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your help.
Guadalupe, thank you for joining us and best of luck to you. Let me turn it to Daryl from South City. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Jeff. I also have a problem with my neighbor. My neighbor is a belligerent alcoholic and has schizophrenia. At least several times a week, he gets really intoxicated, stands in his front yard, and screams. He screams at everything, from other neighbors to passing vehicles, and sometimes to nothing at all. And this goes on for hours, often well past midnight. I've called the police non-emergency number. I requested the officers come, and they do, but all they do is speak to him. Is there anything else I can do to get rid of this incessant nuisance so I can finally get some sleep?
Man, that's a tough one. I mean, it's not really a real estate issue, but we'll try. Right, Bart, we'll try to figure this one out for you. I mean, you've done the right thing calling the police, so you've got a decent, probably, record of the police calls. Have you thought about, you're trying to get a temporary restraining order? I'm not exactly sure what that would do, though, because you're so proximate already. And, you know, the zoning world and the planning world and the city's municipalities outside the police don't really have a vehicle for this. A typical real estate nuisance is something like we just heard about. I mean, that was kind of a nuisance. The previous caller had a situation where somebody was literally dumping stuff and creating a nuisance on their property. Here, you've got a human nuisance and just a crazy person. And man, that's tough. What do you think, Bart?
Yeah, the real estate laws really aren't set up to handle this. I guess as I was listening, I was thinking of the concept of a private nuisance, which is somewhat similar to the last caller. But it's a claim that, you know, really requires you to, unfortunately, need a lawyer to properly assert it. It's a frustration that the police aren't doing more. I think that, but that's pretty typical when I hear about these situations, that they are there to try to calm down the situation at that moment. And that to go further than that, with the sort of habitual activity that you're seeing, you really do have to go and ask a court to issue some order that then if they behave that way, they're violating court order. And that's where they can really ratchet up the penalties.
Exactly. So as I see it, and I work with these restraining orders occasionally, I'm not a real estate attorney, but I am a criminal defense attorney. And what it does is it empowers the police to take action where they wouldn't otherwise. So even making contact with you may be enough to generate a violation of the order. And that's something concrete for them to act on and not be judging who they can best calm down to try to defuse the situation. So that does give you some additional tools.
Yeah. Is there a way to, how does somebody in the caller's position get a TRO? Do they have to retain a lawyer?
A TRO is generally pretty easy to come by. There's actually at some of the courthouses around have somebody to help you fill out the paperwork. But the paperwork's all online. It's all pretty easy to work with. It asks you very specific questions. There's a spot for you to put a narrative on things that have happened. And what you really need to show is that it's ongoing, that it's not a one-off. This is really a pattern, and you have every reason to believe that if there's not intervention, the pattern will continue.
I've litigated these. I had to get these for people. As much detail as possible. Photographs are always going to help. Otherwise, it's a he said, she said. Make sure it has the date and the time. If this person is out there screaming, have a video so the judge can watch the video. As much that you can take out of the he said, she said is going to make your case.
Josh, you also mentioned, this is Andrew, but Josh mentioned in our little chat here, in addition to the private nuisance that's a court action, there's also the idea of a conservatorship. If we had a more robust kind of mental health, you know, infrastructure in our country, the laws kind of are there, but the ability to actually implement them are pretty tough from what I understand. But, you know, there is the ability for the courts to literally take this person kind of into custody if they really are kind of a danger to themselves and it's gotten so crazy and God only knows what's going to happen next. You know, there are laws that would eventually put that person in some kind of protective custody under a conservatorship. So, but that's another kind of long road and lots of expense and very complicated because you're basically taking somebody's liberties away.
Right. Just briefly on that, it would be an involuntary conservatorship of the person, which you can do if someone isn't going to voluntarily conserve themselves or there's not an instrument in there to allow for that. And people aren't going to involuntarily do that. It is a legal process by which the judge does that. It's a very high bar. But if the person has these serious mental health issues, then we have had shows on conservatorships, and maybe you want to go back and listen to that show.
All right. Thank you.
Daryl, thank you for joining us in your legal rights. And Lisa, you've been very patient. You're on your legal rights. Welcome.
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, you're on the air, Lisa. Welcome.
Oh, hi. My name is Ilza.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a little typo at our end. Ilza, welcome to your legal rights.
Thank you very much for having me on. I have two questions, actually, and I just need a bit of information. So I live in a beautiful old building in the Richmond District, and recently my landlord had a bunch of cowboy contractors come in and rip the canopy off the front of the building. There are now two gaping holes on either side where it was attached. I want to know who I have to contact to complain about this.
Well, you're talking about the Richmond neighborhood in San Francisco, yes?
Yes, yes.
So you can go to the city's website. You can probably complain to both and either the planning department or the building department because usually...
To the planning department, okay.
Yeah, usually people are complaining about building new things, and so, you know, without permits. So you clearly need a permit to build something. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure that you would have needed a permit to remove that. Do you know how old your building is in? Kind of back to the historic issues
I believe before. It was built in 1933.
Okay, so it's very likely that what they did could have required some type of planning review because they've clearly altered the look of your building. And if that, was that awning there, as far as you know, like forever?
It's always been there. It was a part of the building.
Yeah, so it's very likely they violated the planning code in some respect. I'm not sure you would have needed a building permit to remove that of some kind, but it's very likely. I would call the planning department's line and talk to somebody, and you don't have to give your name. The enforcement system in San Francisco is very active and very thorough, and if you just explain what's gone on, they will look into it for you, and you can assure
okay.
that. Yep.
And I just have to look online to find their number, right?
Yep. The planning department's website
The other thing is, in the same building, the same landlord is allowing a plumbing business to work out of the building. Huh. And I believe that's not permitted because this is a residential district. So what do I have to do to combat that?
In the same phone call, you'll make two complaints. It's the same people.
Yes.
The planning department's enforcement arm will... that's actually a lot easier. I mean, the awning thing is a little more complicated because of history of the building, whatever. But as we were talking about earlier with respect to just zoning in general, if you're in the Richmond, you're likely in a district that only allows, you know, for the most part, residential uses, no commercial uses.
Yes, I looked it up and it says residential use only.
Exactly. So, you know, the planning department will come and investigate that as well, and they'll try to, sort that out. Yeah, same phone number. Two complaints. Go for it.
Okay.
Let me ask.
All right.
And Elsa, you're in San Francisco, so all you have to do is dial one phone call to 311, and you'll find whoever you need.
Well, there you go. The 311 works pretty well.
That doesn't work in any of the suburbs. Yeah, that doesn't work in the suburbs, but for you in the city, that works great.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Before you go, I know Bart wanted to follow up.
Let me ask a question. It's not clear to me from what you told us if the landlord is in the process of replacing the awnings or just demolished them.
No, he just demolished it.
But you said he left holes in the front of the building?
Yeah, two gaping holes on either side where the awning was attached to the building. He's just left them gaping.
You know he doesn't? Have you asked if he has a plan to come back and put in new awnings? Or?
Well, I asked the people who were ripping the awning out, and they said, oh, no, he's just getting rid of this ugly awning. I said, but that's not an ugly awning. That's a part of a historic building. And you shouldn't be doing that. And they said, well, he told me to do it.
So I would suggest, before you dial 311, you should have a conversation with your landlord. Because you're going to, as long as you're living in that building, you're going to have a relationship with your landlord. And you should at least find out, before you reach out to the city, number one, does he have a permit? And number two, is it his intention to replace the awning? And if he says no and no, then I think dial 311. But it may be he has a plan to do it, and it's just he did a bad job of communicating with his tenants about what he was doing. And hopefully he has a permit if a permit is necessary.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and then I wanted to ask Ashley and Andrew a question regarding your second issue, and that is, Andrew, in San Francisco, do they have something called a home occupation permit where you can, to some extent, conduct a commercial business out of a residential structure?
Yeah, we do have that, but it's extremely limited. It's basically like a kind of a home office issue that everybody has anyway, right? We all have our home offices for doing some work at home. But the minute you're kind of running an operation where it's clearly a commercial operation that should be someplace else, or it draws attention and people start coming and doing business at your home, that's pretty much illegal. So yeah, it's pretty narrow.
Okay. So I will look into these suggestions, and thank you so much for your help.
Thank you for joining us in your legal rights.
Thank you for all your work. I listen every week.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do you want to learn the basics of how to manage your money or your credit, or how to read a credit report, or learn about bankruptcy? Next week on May 26th from 5 to 6 p.m., Legal Access Alameda, in partnership with Elevate Community Center's Executive Director, Shireen Sean, and Bankruptcy Attorney, Sally Elkinkin, will be hosting a Facebook Live event called The Financial Basics. It will be streaming live on Legal Access Alameda's Facebook page. Head to facebook.com/LegalAccessAlameda to tune in. You could submit questions in the chat in order to join in the conversation yourself. The panelists will be talking about the basics of how to budget, bankruptcy, credit reports, and credit scores. But be sure when you join them to hurry back, because at 6 o'clock, Your Legal Rights is here to answer your landlord-tenant questions. That's Your Legal Rights next week at 6 o'clock at our usual time. And let me turn it to Roberta from Alameda. Roberta, thank you for being so patient and waiting. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, thank you so much. This is so timely. It's a huge issue. Going back to something one of your guests said about a matter of right for development of a residential lot, and I'm wondering about the boundaries for that right with respect to existing setback requirements and zoning ordinances. We have an issue where there's a peculiar size lot, and the setback requirements were overridden by a zoning administrator to a single foot on the basis that it would harm the landowner. He would not get the full benefit and an unequal penalty because he would not be able to use his property as other people would. However, he's the only one that has a 22-foot lot since 1909 that wants to build.
Sounds like a variance, right, Bart?
It's a variance, and yes, he was 1 foot. So, the zoning administrator didn't want that to be any kind of problem of varying the setback. He said it would be up to civil disputes between the neighbors after the building is built.
Oh, it's a really good question and a really useful clarification of the statement I made earlier about single-family home being a use allowed as a matter of right.
Yes.
In a single-family home district. And what you're doing is really helping to sort of clarify. There are two issues, and Andrew discussed these earlier in talking about zoning. You have the use issue, and then you have the construction issue. And okay. So the thing that's a matter of right is to have a single-family home, to have a single-family use of single-family property. But the structure in which that use occurs is controlled by zoning. And as you mentioned, the zoning controls the height of the building, how far it is from the street, that's the front setback, and how far it is from the side yards. But there are situations when a piece of land is of either of an unusual shape or it has some unusual physical aspect to it, or it can actually be to something in the surrounding area where in order to let the use as a matter of, which is a matter of right, the single family use occur, the only way to do it is by relaxing one of those physical setback or height rules. And that is this variance process. And from what you've described, in fact, you used some of the buzzwords from the variance laws, which are state laws. It sounds like that's what's happened here, that because of something peculiar about that piece of property, they couldn't have a normal single family home if they stayed with all of the setback and other boundary restrictions. And so the city, applying fairly strict state finding requirements, found that in order to have a single family home, you need that setback reduced to apparently 1 foot on one side of the property.
Now, who defined a normal single family home? Where is that?
Well, that's actually, so this is Andrew now. First off, I want to just clarify, it sounded like the special circumstance here, the uniqueness, was actually the size of the lot. Does that sound right?
Yeah, the width is 22 feet.
Right. So you mean a standard lot is usually like 25 feet, and if it's only 23 feet, there is your physical, you know, issue. I think in, you know, a lot of the variances I deal with in San Francisco are basically substandard lots. I mean, lots where the area is so tiny that the house just fits on it and they don't even have a rear yard, so that anytime they do anything, they need a variance, because when you're standing in the kitchen at the back of the house, you're actually standing technically in the required rear yard, and that just obviously doesn't work. So, you know, variances are there, pretty straightforward. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Bart. It sounds like this was a situation where the zoning administrator, who usually in these jurisdictions has the sole authority, it's not the planning commission, variances are governed by a different decision maker, and that's the zoning administrator. And if he or she decides that the burden's been met, that there's five or six different factors, as Bart was saying, that the state law requires, One of them is these unique, unusual hardship circumstances that they don't control, which is the size of the lot or the width of the lot. That's usually the big one that you get you in the door. And then as long as what you're asking for is pretty reasonable, you know, variances can be justified. But they're not supposed to be given out like candy. You know, they're not as common as conditional uses, for example. It's a really high bar. But usually it's once you get to a physical limitation, you're kind of halfway there.
A 1 foot variance, is that common?
Everyone's different. They're all very unique circumstances. So yeah, the ruling was the setback was only 1 foot as opposed to whatever was otherwise required by the code. Yeah, right, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You did ask an interesting question. What is normal?
Yes. And who decides?
Yeah, so one interesting aspect to variances is they are contextual to their site. So the language in the variance law is looking at the rights enjoyed by properties in the vicinity within the same zoning district. And so typically they'll look at what is around that house and decide, you know, try to make the house on the constrained site as close as it can be to the houses that are around it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's normal. What's normal in your neighborhood would be perhaps very different than what is normal in mine.
Okay. So
let me take Roberta's situation and flip it. What if it's Roberta that was living in the house, or she buys the house on the non-conforming lot, and the neighbors come to her on moving day or just afterwards and tell her, you're way too close to the setback line. Where could she go? Where does she find out about that? And what remedy might she have?
Well, I guess the first line of inquiry would be whether the house was, you know, built with permits. And if so, and it's not unusual, particularly in San Francisco, where a lot of the housing stock is so old that these structures either predate the requirement for building permits or predate the some setback where we've seen a change over time. And in those situations, the structure is legal nonconforming. That's what they call it, legal nonconforming. And Roberta doesn't have to do anything about it. She's got a structure that is allowed to stay right where it is.
Yep, that's another term for legal nonconforming is grandfathered. If it was legal to begin with and the codes have changed and new setback requirements have come in so that it might not be compliant under today's code, but it was compliant under the code that when it was built, good enough. That's grandfathered, legal nonconforming, all's good. So Roberta should maybe just say, hey, everything's fine. Don't worry about me. My house is good.
Roberta, thanks for joining us in your legal rights. But unfortunately, we are out of time.
Okay,
but I would like to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing common real estate issues, real property issues, with our guest Barton Hechtman of Mattioni, O'Loughlin and Hechtman in San Jose, and Andrew Junius of Rubin, Junius and Rose LLP in San Francisco. Next week on Your Legal Rights, be sure to tune in our usual time, 6 o'clock on Wednesday night, where we feature a program on landlord-tenant questions with three of the best, Jessica Chalik and Sal Timpano, both of San Francisco, and San Mateo's David Finkelstein. With yet more programs out there to help landlords collect back rent, and the moratorium on evictions set to end in just weeks, there's a lot to talk about, and due to popular demand, we are here returning to answer your landlord-tenant questions. That's, again, our usual time, Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Our guests tonight, as I said, have been Barton Hechtman and Andrew Junius. Our thanks to them for joining us tonight. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. And our thanks to our guests, and especially our thanks to all of you for joining us. For Josh Borger and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.